matured enough for me to consider to publish anything on them. But in the spirit of this workshop, I thought it would be useful to discuss them, perhaps to motivate some of you to think about those lines, because I don't think that sort of line of thinking is represented enough in the literature on this subject. And just to state the obvious, subject is superluminality within the context of low energy effective field theory, which means that I'll be talking about field theories, very simple ones, which have cutoff, some sort of UV cutoff. And everything that we'd like to do is happening below that cutoff. So only legitimate things that we can be talking about are things below those cutoffs. Now, there have been a number of discussions on propagation, possible superluminal, acausal, et cetera. Certainly, there are some low-energy field theories in which superluminal phase velocities at calculated low energy suggest that they will also propagate superluminal signals, and I'll mention one. But there are also more intricate ones in which, especially with inhomogeneous backgrounds, in which it appears that there's superluminal phase velocity, but you cannot really decide just based on that or just looking at the characteristics. You have to do more work. So what I'll be talking about is how to try to get rid of those superluminalities, whether good or bad, by introducing some low energy degrees of freedom and looking at some loop corrections within the context of effective field theory. So let me begin with the simplest example that already had been mentioned here, and that's just a scalar field with a conventional kinetic term, and it has this quartic interaction with some scale lambda. So this theory is an effective field theory below the scale lambda. If I do calculations at momenta and the values of the fields which are below lambda, this quartic is just a small correction. And then usually we discuss questions like superluminality and possible UV completion. And I should mention that Alberto, Sergei, and others have written an interesting paper on that, which Andrew already mentioned. So a lot of, in this context, will be discussing around that paper, in fact. So as it stands, this will have superluminal propagation, which is bad. In other words, if you calculate propagation of a signal, you're going to get that it propagates superluminally within the framework of effective field theory. There's no question about that. But let me go slowly and explain things about it. So there is a classical solution to this equation. If you write down equations, you're going to get more than one derivative per field. And because of that, there is a solution. Let me call it zeta times t. Zeta is a constant with dimensionality of two powers of mass, and t is time. And we'd like to understand fluctuations around this solution. And before you do that, you can also see what this background represents. So it's got some density and some pressure that you can calculate in a straightforward way. And the numbers, if I remember the numbers right, you're going to get something like this for density. This term comes obviously from here. And this term comes from here. So the pressure will be zeta squared over 2 plus c zeta to the fourth divided by 2 lambda to the fourth. Now, if c is greater than 0, all is fine. I mean, there is nothing special about that background. So this is the dominant piece. This, we think, is a small correction because zetas are, the scale of lambda are small corrections, and c's are not big numbers in this consideration. So for c greater than 0, rho is bigger than pressure, and this is just conventional, some sort of cosmology. On the other hand, if c is less than 0, then you notice that this piece is negative and bigger than this piece, therefore density is less than pressure. And that's a violation of the dominant energy condition. So, which suggests that there must be something superluminal about that, because that's what the dominant energy condition is. So let's look at what sort of superluminalities you get. So you can expand around background. So these are all known things that I'm just repeating out of certain authors. So you're going to get the kinetic term, and then you're going to get the gradient term. And the story will be very, very similar. So this one is bigger. And this one is smaller. And I'm not entirely certain about these numbers, but the point is that this coefficient is bigger than this coefficient, and therefore the same story repeats, which is that C greater than zero, you got omega equals to VK, where V is less than one, and C less than zero, you got omega equals to VK, where V is greater than one. And this is a homogeneous background. Nothing can help this because, again, so light cone is broader. You can wait, as Massimo was saying, 2 weeks, and you're going to get superluminal propagation of your train, of your wave. So that will be the delivery of superluminal signal. It's a separate story whether you can have time-like curves and, you know, whether perturbations there are strong, and most likely they will be strong, obviously. That's a separate story. So we are already at this point concerned that if I can, or happy, I don't know. I mean, it would be good to communicate superluminally to somebody as long as it's a consistent and meaningful way of doing things. But the fact of the life is that. So that's what's happened in this theory. So one interesting connection that was also made in that paper that I mentioned by Alberto Sergei Edaras is a connection of this with the low energy behavior of the 2x2 scattering amplitude. So maybe I should write here. So if you look at the 2 into 2, so this is 2 pi mod. All right, so this is a diagram, S-channel diagram, T-channel diagram, and the U-channel diagram. Pi, 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 pi. And if you look at the forward scattering amplitude, this is going to scale as C times S squared divided by lambda to the fourth, just for simple counting from the Lagrangian. So what they observed is that you can relate this through unitarity, through optical theorem. You can relate this to total cross-section of this pi-pi scattering. And the assumptions that go into that consideration, the standard ones actually, which Andrew just reviewed, that you satisfy a certain bound on behavior of the amplitudes. Actually, what you should consider is the let me call it little a, which would be forward scattering amplitude divided by S cubed, which has 1 over S singularity, and that's a residue that you calculate, and then you get that C divided by lambda cubed has to be some positive number times integral ds S sigma S divided by S cubed. And this part being positive also tells you that C has to be positive. So which means that if you assumed a UV completion, which certain convergent or you know, nicely behaved cross-section at high energies, then that assumption implies that the low energy constant should be positive. Okay, so now, obviously, as I said, already the superluminality was kind of bad in a sense of being physical. So the question would be, can we do something in low energies so that it modifies the story that I'm just describing to you? I would like to look at one simple modification in that context. Actually, can do this. Let me add to that Lagrangian, the Lagrangian of a new field, which is within the low energy field theory. I'm going to call it phi, and this could be many things. But for simplicity, I'll take a scalar. Let's say phi 4. Those things are not, okay, so this term is important for me. So there is some scalar with some mass, could have some interaction, but it's important it has interaction with the pi just like this, and it's important that its mass is less than lambda. Now you may ask me about the hierarchy and the, you know, stuff like that between m and lambda. You know, if you push me too much, I'm going to give you a more complicated model in which they'll be okay. But I don't care. Order of magnitude hierarchy is okay for me. So it's a little hierarchy between these two scales. It's fine for my argument as long as m is just a little less than lambda. Okay? So the virtue of this is that I get the same, exactly the same solution as before in the classical Lagrangian. Because my equation for pi has another piece, which comes from here, which has two powers of phi. So if I'm choosing pi classical equals to zeta times t, while phi classical equals to zero, that still is a solution. And the same for phi, because it's never linear, so phi equals to zero is a solution.
Yes. Is q dimensionful
here? No, q is the dimensionless constant, because this is dimension. I'm sorry, I meant two powers here. I apologize. Yes. I'm sorry. Yes. Okay. And q is dimensionless, yeah. That's still a solution. And let's now do expansion about the very fluctuations about the very same solution. Classical expansion as we've done on that piece of that blackboard. So the new term, one important new term that you will generate will come from this term. In particular, you will have term which is q times the background and times, you know, 1 over lambda square times tau tilde.
Okay, so what's the
full theory is that theory plus this theory. Yes, this is delta L addition to that. So tau tilde times phi square. So that's the new vertex that you generate. Just because you take one of these pi's on the background, and then you get zeta here, and then you get this. But now you can look at the renormalization of the tau kinetic term. It's this diagram, where the dot lines denote phi's, and these lines denote phi. I'm sorry, tau dots. Okay. So this diagram is a well, I defined for you tau right here. It's a fluctuation of pi. So there is a cubic vertex between fluctuation of pi, time derivative, and phi square. And that gives you a new vertex like this. And if you calculate this, this has a log piece in it, which you cannot renormalize away, because this has something to do with the unitarity, in fact, with the fact that there is the imaginary part of at high energies, you can produce, you know, two phi particles, and this is a new cut in your complex S plane. So you're gonna get something like q squared zeta squared divided by lambda to the fourth times tau tilde and log, and let me write this log schematically this way, but I'll comment on it. So of course this log is a momentum dependent, but now I'm taking momenta much lower than the mass. The reason why I'm doing that is because from that sort of arguments over there, what's important is the low S behavior of whatever amplitude I have. So that's the piece that I'm interested in. So other piece is also important for other things, in particular for that cut on the complex plane, but for this purpose, that's what it's enough. So you generate this with a positive term. So that means that now if I put together two things,
No.
So this is the momentum dependent part taken at small momenta. This has physics in it. That's why you cannot tune it.
I'm saying the fact that you evaluated n square rather than p square means that you choose your counterterms in order to remove precisely this, in principle.
Well, then you lose the normal physical interpretation, which is that you want to be producing massive particle at the threshold, which is 4m squared.
I guess what I'm saying is that the complete answer, which also depends on momenta, and which
yes.
is very close to momenta higher than m square.
Yes. Well, it's complete answer. Let me write here parenthetically. It's integral dx log of m square minus s x 1 minus x divided by lambda squared. This is from 0 to 1. And when you integrate, you're going to get correct threshold in a complex plane right here at 4m squared.
Exactly. And I'm saying that physical interpretation and that correct cut has to do with the s dependence, not with the m squared dependence.
Well, they come together. These two come together. There is other piece which I've subtracted. That's the one we are talking about.
Yeah, I'm saying oh. I could choose a counter term that removes precisely what you've written down there at low end.
No, you cannot. Because you violate the unit the optical theorem.
No, because that term that you wrote down there does not depend on S. So
well, this is okay. Think of this term as being this term. I'm just simplifying here. It's this term that I wrote here. And that I cannot remove. I that has something to do with the unitarity of the low energy unitarity of the theory.
I claim you cannot remove the S
dependence. No, that's not true because, so you're saying you can put M to zero here?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that there's always a counter term that they use to remove the vertices, and I could tune, so whatever counter term you used, I could add to that counter term precisely that log that you've written down there.
Let me repeat once again. So this log is log M square minus S, precisely with the cut that I want it to be. So I wrote this schematically for this purpose, and I made the disclaimer. So it's this. In fact, what I'm giving you is the kind of simplified version of Coleman-Weinberg. What you should do is you calculate Coleman-Weinberg and keep all the logs consistent with random normalization, etc. So this is a piece. In your 2x2 amplitude, this is a piece you have to include. You cannot remove it by any counterterms. But this is the piece that I'm talking about.
Okay. Okay. Let's think about it. What I'm saying is that there's an ambiguity in terms of
there is ambiguity.
Local terms. So the local terms are never unambiguous. So the moment you extrapolate S.
This is not a local term. This is precisely a log term. That's why I'm saying that you there is no ambiguity in keeping this term.
Yeah,
but the local terms have subtracted those ambiguities.
Because of the S in the term. So
that's precisely because of S.
Yeah,
because analyticity. Analyticity of this amplitude is defined by this function.
I agree.
That's it. You cannot move it around.
I cannot move that around, but I'm saying that term you wrote down without S is totally ambiguous.
Look, I mean, I explained that I was just schematically referring to this term. Okay, this is the right term. I don't know how many times can I repeat one of the same things. I mean,
Alberto, are you asking why the log, the lambda inside the log is the same as the lambda itself?
No, he was under the impression that I was just putting here a local term, which is completely arbitrary, which is a cutoff dependent term. But that's not what I was writing. I said it, so I didn't want to write this in Feynman parameterization. Okay, look, I mean, so let me continue about what's important. So you get either, you can look that way, or you can look at think in terms of the 2x2 scattering, but you have this extra piece. Okay, and if you were to run that sort of argument or this sort of argument, you would get at low energies, you would get a different condition for C, namely that C would be bigger than Q squared, zeta squared divided by lambda to the fourth.
Okay, so
minus.
Pi is a massive field, right? So you can integrate it out.
Yes.
And then you will
yes.
Pi,
that's right.
Right. C and
of course, yeah. That's right. So then that's what Coleman, if you did Coleman, full-scale, full-fledged Coleman-Weinberg, that's what Sergei is saying, you would get that. So what this condition says now is that C could be now a little bit negative, right? So as long as this overcompensates for C, C by itself could be negative. So in a sense, this is kind of, well, you know, for arbitrary C, this is kind of quantum delay of a superluminal signal, because you know if C is still big, you still have superluminality, but it's delayed. But you can have also small Cs to begin with in that Lagrangian, and then this could overcompensate that C, depending on what your couplings are and things like that. Then it will be subluminal. The velocities will be subluminal, okay? So let's see now how that ties into the scattering amplitude. I almost said that already, but it's identical story, because now in the, okay, so instead of writing, because I spent only a lot of time, I'll just repeat. You get this log, S-dependent log, in the amplitude, unambiguously. Then you take 1 over S cubed of that amplitude. So that amplitude now has this log. And then you go to S goes to 0 pole, because that's what you are calculating. That's what this dispersion integral calculates. The cut is there. So the mass, the mass particle only contributes to the cut. So it's already included in the total cross section. So you will get modification of that C. And the modification is exactly these modifications that I just described to you, simply because the diagram here is this one. Right? And again, this is log of m squared minus x. And once you calculate the residue, on the residue, it will be precisely that log that I wrote schematically before, which is independent of s. Of course, log of cutoff squared divided by m squared. So that way, so you see, what I want to emphasize is that there is a classical theory. As I said, in classical theory, you do have background, which is a solution of your equations of motion. You look at the fluctuations at the classical level, and they are really superluminal. Signals propagate faster than light. But quantum corrections, these quantum corrections, can change that as long as the initial coefficient, that initial coefficient wasn't too big, or depending, depending on these parameters. Right? So this is not in contradiction in anything, because we modified theory in the IR. So this was kind of IR obstruction to, that argument was presented as IR obstruction to U completion. So what happened here is that we modified IR so that the new theory now may allow for a UE completion. Okay?
You've only passed the first test.
What?
You've only passed the first, this is only the first test.
Of course, yeah, of course, but this is a kind of possible way to go.
So,
yes?
I don't really understand your logic. I mean, obviously the bare coupling constants that appear in Lagrangian don't mean anything, but really the physical renormalized coupling constants are the ones that matter. The C itself doesn't really mean anything. So if you add traction, you have to renormalize it, and the physical observables are things that matter. So that's
what I'm saying is that here is your low energy effective Lagrangians, in which you've supposedly you've gotten this Lagrangian by integrating out some high energy stuff.
Right.
So all these couplings that you wrote in the low energy Lagrangian, of course they are running couplings, but they are normalized at scale lambda, because that's the cutoff.
Right.
Okay. Now in order to deduce physics what's below that scale, you've got to take also loops of that effective field theory with that cutoff lambda and with those values of the parameters. And then what I'm saying is that if you just treated that classically in this example, you would have gotten and concluded that there is a superluminality.
Right.
However, if you treated it well, there is no superluminality.
So classically, you can estimate the size of loop corrections. You will see that the superluminality is at the same level as the loop correction. So you need to calculate.
Yeah. Yeah,
sorry,
so there is not.
Could you say this, that if you now did an even more effective Lagrangian integrating below M?
No, that's what I said.
Yeah.
So that C would change.
Right.
So, in other words, So along those lines, I mean, if I integrated out, if I integrated out precisely, completely the M, so there are two points about that, right? So let me answer your point and then another one. So if I integrated completely the phi, I would have, written the Coleman-Weinberg with all this. So this is phi. This loop is phi. Then these are, d pi's. I would have written Coleman-Weinberg, which would have log, in which besides the m squared would be d pi squared. term, et cetera, et cetera. So as you know, Sergey mentioned before. But then there is another point, which is that this is valid not only below M, but also between M and lambda. So this theory is a good theory all the way to lambda, not only to M. Okay, so let me. This is relatively easy for this sort of theory. What I'm going to argue now is that for Galileans, I wasn't able to do the same. So it's not that easy, and that's a part maybe you know the audience can participate. Not necessarily now, but once out. But nevertheless, let me run my arguments, and I wish I could do it, but I'm encountering some impediments. So let's go to the Galileans. And let me discuss the simplest one again. The cubic Galilean. So unlike in a previous theory, this has additional symmetry, which is, as you know well, which is the Galilean symmetry. And that's what distinguishes it from that one, because that one only had shift symmetry. And needless to say that, of course, whatever we add, we should add in a way that we retain that symmetry. So you can think, what sort of can I play a similar type of game? Obviously, you cannot just add d pi square phi square, the one like that, because it's not Galilean invariant. But you may try to add the following term. So let me. Let me write this schematically without putting indices. So these are two epsilon tensors, and then these are two derivatives of pi. This is a known total derivative in four dimensions, which is d mu d nu pi squared minus box pi squared, and it's a Galilean invariant object that would participate into two cross section, right? So we are out of two cross section. Still 2 pi into 2 pi. Now, if I just write down this and multiply by phi square, that's not going to do the job because it's going to give you too many derivatives. So this would be you're going to get s squared in each vertex, and this could be only log, and you're going to get s squared in this vertex. So that's s to the 4. So that's not necessarily good. Well, that's not good. But you could try to write the following vertex. Okay, because this vertex is now, it is Galilean invariant, but also this 1 over box would reduce for you powers of s. So before I continue with this, let me mention what the philosophy is at this point. I should have said this from the very beginning. So for Galileans, there is also the argument in a paper by Adams et al. That if you assume, and this is the argument that Andrew just reviewed, in fact, if you assume the existence of the Fruasar bound, which is an assumption in that theory, then you can have this you know spectral integral, and that would imply positivity of the second derivative of the amplitude in a certain point in a complex plane. So philosophy here is this, that let me try to modify this theory in the infrared so that assumption likely holds, because you know I make nicer UV behavior maybe through that. And that could be the case if I have gotten S squared behavior in the amplitude, according to that paper. So that would be the philosophy. So it's a testing of that option, but maintaining Galilean invariance. So then this sort of vertex by itself would do the job. Because the reason why is because you have now this, and let me denote these vertices like this. Okay, so this would be s squared. I would have gotten 1 over s here, then I would have gotten log, then I would have gotten 1 over s, and then I would have gotten s squared, and in total this would be s squared. And that's what you want to have. Okay, so that's fine, but then there is a problem with this. So the problem is this. So how can you rewrite this in a local form? So naively, at a first glance, you would think that that should be easy because, you know, 1 over box is not really a non-locality, just a massless mode that has been integrated out. But remember, if you have, but remember when you integrate out massless modes, you don't typically get only, you know, one operator, one over box, the other operator, which would be a cross term. You also get operator, one over box operator, cross term, as well as the other operator, one over box, other operator. Okay. So then let me try to think how would I do with integrating a massless mode to get this. And if I had two operators, A plus B times some sigma, which now sigma is a new massless field coupled to it. If I've integrated out the sigma, I would have gotten A plus B, 1 over Laplacian A plus B. And then I only need, remember, I only need to somehow get only the cross term. So I would write A minus B times some other term, some other scalar. But to get the right sign, to cancel the diagonal terms, that other sign has to be a ghost, right? Because A minus, you know, A minus B would give you the right, you know, cross term when I sum it up. However, the diagonal terms have to cancel. And the only way you can cancel is that if that other scalar is a ghost. So that's not good. So you cannot get only this. Then you say, fine, let me not have only that. Let me have whatever baggage it comes with. And that is that I take this theory. So this is, again, addition to the Lagrangian. So let's say this divided by lambda cube. Now I have, you know, some parameter times phi square. I have the sigma. And then I have, you know, d sigma squared. Right? So again, if I integrate out sigma, I'm going to get this operator, 1 over box, that operator. And it will include this term, but will also include the diagonal terms. So the only challenge would be to see the diagonal terms don't spoil the game, but unfortunately they do. And to see, the easiest way to see that they do is actually you don't have to integrate, you just keep it and then see what it gives rise to. So to, again, 2 by 2 amplitude is now this diagram. Then you have this diagram. And then you have all the other bubbles as well. So this is the sigma propagator. And, you know, this would be S squared, 1 over S squared. So this is S cubed. That's not quite good. This would be S squared, 1 over S log 1 over S, S squared. This is already beginning to be good because 2 powers of S cancel out. It's S squared. But then there is a, the next order, you see there is a problem because this is increasing powers of inverse S. The, each loop gives only a log dependence of S, while each propagate gives 1 over S. So in the infrared, further terms are more and more divergent. So the only thing you can do is to sum them up, right? So this, let me call this double line propagator, which would be just the sum of these propagators. And that summation would give you whatever three-level result you had, let's say Q squared log with appropriate power.
But you're saying so, that sigma normalizes the mass of phi.
Yes. Yes. It's in more subtle than that because it creates the, in a complex plane, it creates the imaginary pole that goes under the cut. But essentially, from the point of view of counting S's, that's exactly what it is. So you see that this dressed propagator has, these were the terms, you know, I divided and multiplied by S. These were the terms which were 1 over S, and but the resummed, this was the part that was resummed, so that had 1 over S, which then flips and goes up and makes it S. Therefore, you're not really able to cancel extra powers F that you'd like to cancel. Okay, so this doesn't work. The next thing you can, I tried to do. Yes?
So, those epsilon or E's, what are they? Are they really?
Yeah, these are the epsilon Levitch. So that term is.
What do you mean then? Because if you have two derivatives on pi, that's already invariant.
Yeah, yeah, it's already invariant, but you know this forms appear. This form appear in all the Galilean constructions, and you know, you could do this, everything that I said you could do just with box pi, but then I wanted, of course, to complete this in a more nicer theory, also make connection with the decoupling limit of massive gravity, in which. Well, yeah, but it's not working. It's not fortunate. I mean, it's not fortunate. No matter how you do, it's not what you wanna get, right? So, and here is another reason why I was doing that is because you can also try to do one more step. You can say, let me write terms like this, you know, with or without indices here, open or contracted, times phi squared. This is pretty much the term that I started with. This is not Galilean invariant, but you can introduce somebody else who compensates for it, and we know who compensates. There is a tensor field that you can introduce. If chi, I call it a trace of the tensor field, multiplies the same phi squared, this combination is Galilean invariant, or if I've written it in a more general form, this combination is the one that's Galilean invariant. This transforms, and this is what appears in massive gravity. In fact, this is one of the redefinitions that Claudia and I did when we diagonalize. So in the original picture, Galilean invariance involves only pi's. In the diagonalized picture, it involves both pi's and chi's. So this would be that diagonal chi, which transforms under Galilean transformations. So you can hope for that. But you know, I don't want to bore you. I mean, if you follow the details, first you conclude that this chi has to be a massive graviton, but it's not massive graviton in which you know, in the decoupling limit mass goes to zero. That's point one. Point number two, you conclude also that it has to have other mixing terms with the pi's, and then when we take whole thing together, they cancel each other. So there is no contribution, there is no S square contribution to the 2/2 amplitude. Again, it's very subtle, nevertheless, it is what it is. So I'm not sure what to take of this second exercise. It could be that I didn't work hard enough, which is true. I didn't work hard enough to, but the kind of ideas that are on the surface, which work for, they work for that model. They don't work for the Galileans, but maybe there are some better ideas. And you know, I'll be happy to discuss with anybody who may have some interesting thoughts about this. I'll stop here.
So you agree that there is a
Pellegrinian
invariant fixed set? Is that the idea?
I didn't say that, did I? There I said. So there I said this was because look. I mean, again, this goes back to this discussion. So if you have homogeneous background and in which you find a characteristic which is superluminal in low energy theory, I have a hard time imagining how you can avoid superluminal transition of information. Okay. However, if you have backgrounds which are not homogeneous, then that's not guaranteed. The characteristic does not guarantee that you can transfer within the low energy effective field theory information in a superluminal way. In fact, this QED in the external GR background is an example of that. Now, in Galileans, the Weinstein solutions on which you know there are superluminalities, they do exhibit. They are in homogeneous solutions. So somebody has to do that calculation. I don't think that has been done to satisfaction. There are other backgrounds in Galileans, like X square backgrounds or things like this, out of which are homogeneous, even though irrespective of their appearance, they are homogeneous because of Galilean invariance, on which you can have superluminal, most likely you can have superluminal signals. And then maybe you can cook some configurations out of that, and that will be real superluminality. However, you know, I'm in that stage of being open-minded about those things. And you know, obviously, I would prefer to have a theory which in the infrared already is already such due to these quantum corrections that I don't have to worry about those questions. So that was the attempt here. So that's the philosophy.
But also for Weinstein solution, because here, it's really characteristic of the one different from that. So what says you give this?
In Galileans, yes.
Yeah, for Galileans,
right.
Even so, it's homogeneous.
Right.
Propagation
it's not small.
Square root of three, so
yes, it's
if
not
you
small.
Take a small function, you get
yes, Yes. Most likely, when you do that exercise, in that case, you're going to most likely, I'm saying. But in other examples in which you have, you know, fluctuations about some wave backgrounds and things like this, again, these things should be checked. Besides, of course, characteristic equations. Yes.
So, if I think correctly, so the philosophy of B, is there a way to somehow make the amplitude go like S squared?
That's right. Then I would be comfortable to use your idea, which now, right now I'm not.
Which
idea? At high energies, these Galileans have Froissart bound.
I see. Okay.
But in fact, we know that they don't, right? Or at least some of them. So, I'm trying to justify your idea.
If the amplitude goes like S squared, it's
yes.
analytic in the momenta.
Yes.
And so usually we interpret that as a sign of locality. So we interpret that as an indication that there should be a local term in the Lagrangian that produces exactly that amplitude. But we know that there's no Galilean invariant involving only pi that behaves at S squared. No?
Well, you see, it could be some effective Lagrangian, right? So in a fundamental Lagrangian, you may not be able to write that, but in effective Lagrangian, somehow it manifests and gives you right dependence. So that was the.
Right.
Because of the loops.
You know, locality implies an elliptic, but not vice versa.
Yeah, this is what's called
rational
term. Right.
Rational.
Rational term.
Polynomial terms is the amplitude, which nevertheless uniquely fits
every constant cancellation between propagators and stuff.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
So that's why quantum loops, yeah.
I'm perplexed about whether you're associating this superluminality, even if it means superluminal propagation of information, with causality or not, with causal problems or not. Are you or not?
So it's a long story.
It's related to why you want to keep it. You see what I mean? I mean, what is the reason that actually tells you, I would prefer a theory that.
Well, actually, in this example that I discussed, that was related to difficulty with the UV completion. So, sure. I mean, at certain, broad level, we want to understand what's completion or whatever it is about lambda 3 in Galileans and massive gravity, things like this. So, if there are some solid arguments which prohibit that, which in this case I consider it solid, then I would like to improve on it. In Galileans, I'm not sure about those arguments. However, this I consider as a working tool to understand, where, to prove those arguments. And that's the philosophy at a broader level. But that's not your first question.
The point is that, I mean, as long as there is another metric, which there is in this case, in the example that you brought, right, in which, there is an upper speed of
right.
information again, because there's another metric where your perturbation propagates in, and you remain within the LIGO of that metric. I don't see why there's necessarily a violation of
the I have not gone. Though that's a complicated discussion, which is somewhat separate from what we can talk about. That it's a very interesting subject.
That's
but
what's happening here, right? Here you've got the three-level Lagrangian, has
right.
superluminal solutions.
Right.
Whereas the quantum effective action
does not.
It's luminal.
That's right. That's why I was
so
saying that this is a different.
Where the front velocity gets corrected to be one, even
right.
though at three level it's not.
Right. Right.
Okay, maybe we can save further questions and thank Gregory again.